Welcome to episode 21 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. Thank you for joining us. We are lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. And I'm joined today by Jason Weinstein, formerly with the Justice Department, where he oversaw criminal computer crimes prosecutions, among other things, now doing criminal and civil litigation at Steptoe. Hopefully, shortly, by Michael Vadas, formerly with the FBI and the Justice Department, now a partner in Steptoe's New York office. By Maury Schenck, who's an advisor in our London office, specializing in telecom and internet matters. And our guest commentator for the day is Peter Schaar, who is currently the chairman of the European Academy for Freedom of Information and Data Protection, EAID, which is a new NGO in Europe focused on data protection issues. I knew him from 2003 to 2013 when he was the Federal Commissioner for Data Protection and Freedom of Information in Germany. He currently also works as a guest lecturer at the University of Hamburg. Welcome, Peter.
Welcome.
And we'll come back to Peter after our news roundup. I'm Stuart Baker, formerly with the NSA and the Department of Homeland Security, and returning to Steptoe & Johnson for the umpteenth time. So let's get started. We're back to This Week in NSA because the House of Representatives passed a compromise, a sort of compromise bill between the version that had been put forward to control NSA's 215 metadata program by the Judiciary Committee and the version that had been put forth by the House Intelligence Committee. The bill made modest changes in the last day or two before it went to a vote to the bill that had been agreed between the two committees. The privacy groups are crying foul, saying the bill isn't as good as it was. This is a remarkably small issue, as I understand it. The principal objection from the privacy groups to the latest version requires that you understand what the bill was trying to do, which is to get rid of bulk collection of data using Section 215, and to say, no, the government must present an actual identifier or a search term. And the search term relates to an individual, perhaps his name or his account number or the entity that, if it's not a person, it's an entity. And that was the original language, that those were the terms and the only terms that could be used to collect information on terrorism under Section 215. What the FBI, it appears, and perhaps others in the administration said was, wait a minute, that might not be the only reason, that might be not be the only identifier that we have that would produce relevant terrorism information. And they pointed to a couple of things, address or device. So you might only know that a particular device with a unique identifier is being used for terrorism purposes, and you might want a company to do a search for that identifier and tell you what the identifier has been doing. Same thing with address, where certainly if it's an internet address, you would want that. So the list of search terms that private companies can be asked to search on was expanded to five. And then in what seems to be the most controversial aspect of this, the bill adds identifiers such as those five things, leaving open the possibility that somebody could think of another search term that was relatively individualized but not on the list. And the privacy groups are saying, well, that just leaves too much room for creativity, too much ambiguity about exactly what is allowed and what is not. a pretty modest difference between the parties, but the privacy groups have made it seem as though it's a very large difference, and I'm sure we have not heard the end of this discussion because Senator Leahy has indicated that when it gets to the Senate, he's going to want to look closely at trimming that back further. Otherwise, the bill is done in the House and going to the Senate, and it now looks to me as though it's pretty likely something will pass. The only question will be whether the privacy groups decide that they would rather have nothing and will fight to stall the bill rather than accept this compromise. My guess is they'd be so foolish to do that we will see a bill sometime in the next several months. So that's this week in NSA. Glenn Greenwald has promised actually a grand finale, which at least the finale part will be a relief to many in government. The grand, he claims that he's got a list of all the Americans who have been targeted by NSA. That will be interesting to see whether he does, remembering that Snowden actually said at the very beginning that sitting at his desk he could wiretap anyone, and people like me have remarked that it's been nearly a year and he's yet to demonstrate that he could wiretap anybody, so perhaps this has been something that he and Greenwald have been holding back. So that will be an interesting result, or at least an interesting publication. One question I had, Jason, did you happen to think a little bit about what the FBI is likely to be able to do with 215 under the more narrow four or five part test that we were just talking about?
Well, you know, I think that one of the reasons why the effort to limit the search terms is so damaging to law enforcement is that it severely constrains the FBI's ability to use 215 for other types of data. You know, the FBI doesn't just use 215 for telephone metadata, but for other types of data as well. And to the extent that Congress overly restricts the ways in which the FBI can search the data that it obtains from providers, that's going to affect it's going to affect these non-telephone types of data as well.
Yeah, I think that's right, that everybody's focused on making sure that NSA can't misuse this to start a bulk data collection process, but I think they're going to really hurt the tailored collection processes as well, but in ways that are a little hard to predict. Michael, we're about to, LabMD has gone to trial, if I understand it. Can you give us an update on where the trial in front of the FTC administrative law judge stands?
Yeah, it just started last week, and the most notable thing, I think, is that the FTC has now raised a whole host of security problems that LabMD allegedly had. You know, initially, the focus was on the fact that an employee of LabMD was allowed to load LimeWire onto the company's network, and that ended up sharing the medical data of, or at least the personal information of 9,300 consumers. But now the FTC lawyer said that that was only the tip of LabMD's security iceberg, and he said that the company actually had so many problems that it was, you know, almost too many to mention. And he said, for instance, the company allowed employees to log on for years using LabMD as their password, didn't update its operating systems and software, didn't require employees to use authentication security measures, didn't limit employee access to sensitive information that wasn't necessary to their job, and didn't regularly review its firewall. So I think they're making a concerted effort to say, look, this is not just a bully of a government agency trying to hold a company responsible for one little security problem. This is a company that really had shoddy security across the board. And I think, you know, if they can make that case factually, I think that's going to strengthen the FTC's case a whole lot for the ALJ.
Yeah, although I'm not sure it really solves the bullying charge. It's like saying, sure, you can fight this speeding ticket, but we're going to go back and find every parking violation you ever made, every time you looked away from the road to turn on the radio, because all of that is now relevant about whether you're a reckless driver.
Well, but in this case, you know, the issue is whether they had reasonable security, so they're not reaching back into previous things that are only kind of tangentially related. It's not just the security failure that led to the actual breach. You know, they review whether you had good security, period. And the breach is simply what brings the case to the FTC's notice. So, you know, I think all this stuff is fair game.
Yeah, well, it certainly says to people who have been settling these cases that the alternative is not just that they will fine you, but that they will try to up the ante by finding other security problems that hadn't come to light and punishing you for those as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, unless LabMD prevails ultimately at the 11th Circuit or whatever court of appeals it decides to appeal to, you know, this whole proceeding is not going to change things. Everybody is still likely to settle with the FTC, you know, other than the one or two outliers who want to make a big political statement like LabMD does.
Yep. Well, the analogy to what the European Union and the data protection authorities are doing is obvious. Once you're in their bad books, they have all the authority they need to make your life miserable and put you out of business if they choose to. And the FTC is demonstrating that if anybody doubted that they had that ability, they're gonna make an example of LabMD.
And then when we saw Target's CEO forced to resign, you know, I think that sort of brought it to a personal level. Not that that was the result of an FTC investigation necessarily, but, you know, it just reiterates, I think, that you want to get out of the news as fast as you can if you suffer a breach, because bad things happen to the company and to executives if you stay on the front page more than one or two days.
Yep, that sounds exactly right. Well, speaking of the front pages, the People's Liberation Army hasn't gotten off the front pages yet. Their indictment provoked a very kind of unimaginative response from China. They just denied it. They just declared that this fairly very detailed indictment is a work of fiction, which is kind of, you know, no reasonable reader of the newspapers or the indictment could have come to that conclusion. And I assume that's just their placeholder, and they'll think of something more aggressive and imaginative to do. Jason, what do you think China could do to demonstrate how unhappy they are about this?
Well, you know, as you said, I don't think the response up to now has been terribly creative, except in terms of the words used in its enthusiasm to trash talk the indictment. It appeared to me that the Chinese government had broken out the thesaurus to find strong adjectives to attack both the evidence in the indictment and the U.S. decision to bring it. So some of the language was creative, but the message itself was not particularly creative. And as you know, China withdrew from the U.S. China bilateral cybersecurity working group as a sign of protest. You know, there are early signs of possible retaliation against U.S. companies or potential market penetration problems for U.S. companies, some of which, frankly, the companies were already experiencing in the post-Snowden era and that have now only gotten potentially worse. For example, the Chinese government has already announced that it's going to have new procedures for vetting foreign information technology companies before they're allowed to do business with parts of the Chinese government that are involved in national security or public safety. Now, that's perceived largely as a reaction to Snowden, but I'm sure the timing of the announcement of those procedures is no coincidence. Spokespeople for the Foreign Ministry and the Defense Ministry have both warned of unspecified retaliation against companies, and there are reports that the U.S. and U.S. companies are worried about potential tariff and trade issues that might be arise as a result of this. You know, I think if typical practice is followed, the U.S. likely already has filed a red notice for the five defendants. You know, unless they vacation in the wrong country, I don't think anyone seriously expects to ever see them in a U.S. courtroom. I think it's fair to say that their bucket list is now confined to things you can do inside China. Fortunately for them, it's a big country, and they never have to leave it. But I think that there is plenty of reason for, you know, and DOJ, as you know, is predicting more cases of this type. So I think that as much as U.S. companies appreciate the fact that the U.S. has now backed up its words with actions and saying, you know, not only do we have proof of Chinese spying, but we have proof beyond reasonable doubt, and as much as I think U.S. companies are emboldened by the fact that DOJ is doing this, I think there's anxiety about the about what China might do to interfere with those companies that want to be able to have a robust business in China. Some of that is unavoidable, and as I said, some of that was already materializing post-Snowden. I do think that one of the more interesting things about the week after the indictment was announced actually came on the U.S. side, and that is that Senator Carl Levin and John McCain and Jay Rockefeller and Tom Coburn co-sponsored really quite a little bipartisan group there. Co-sponsored a bill called the Deter Cyber Theft Act, which I think is the second time the bill has been introduced, and it echoes a lot of ideas that you've written about, Stuart. The bill would authorize the president to direct the Treasury Department to freeze the assets of any person or company determined to have benefited from cyber-related theft of intellectual property or proprietary information. It creates a new category of sanctions under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, and would essentially allow the government to create a watch list of countries engaging in this type of activity. You know, as we've talked about before and you've written a lot about, the companies that profit from the work of hackers like the guys in the PLA have to do business globally if they're going to be successful in this economy, and doing business globally exposes them to actions that could be taken by not just the U.S., but other countries in which they operate as well. So the fact that Senator Levin and his colleagues are viewing the next evolution of this effort as being not just criminal cases, but actions that could actually impact the financial incentives for companies to engage in or facilitate this conduct, I think is encouraging.
Yeah. So I noticed that the indictment talks a lot about state-owned enterprises that seem to be knowing recipients of the stolen information. Those guys must be high on the list of either future indictments or future sanctions of the sort that Senator Levin and Senator McCain are considering.
I would think so.
Yeah.
What about the international reaction? You think there's already an Interpol red notice for these hackers?
Well, you know, typical practice is followed. You know, anytime you've got an international fugitive, especially one who is residing in a country that doesn't extradite or is unlikely to, it's common practice to have a red notice up just in case the person does go to the wrong country. When I was at the department, we got our hands on some hackers from Eastern Europe who resided in countries that would never have extradited them, but were, you know, went on vacation in France or other countries where we do have cooperative relationships, and either through red notice or through information provided by other agencies, law enforcement got wind that these guys are traveling, and law enforcement here and in a foreign country were able to respond and arrest them. So my guess is that there is a red notice, although, as I said, I think that it's unlikely these guys will ever leave their country.
Well, it certainly does seem like that would be unwise of them to do, although it would certainly create a mess for whatever third country they go to. It will be a test of China's soft power and the U.S.'s soft power in this regard.
That's right. You know, interestingly, I was just going to add that Jim Comey, the FBI director, had an interesting response to the Chinese assertion that the indictment was embarrassingly weak and that the evidence was fabricated, and he basically met trash talk with trash talk and said publicly, if the Chinese think that the indictment is bogus and that the evidence is fabricated, they should come over here and put the U.S. government to the test. And, you know, with the protections, they would enjoy the same protections that any criminal defendant in the U.S. would, a U.S. citizen or otherwise, would enjoy, including the presumption of innocence and requirement that the government convince a jury unanimously beyond a reasonable doubt. And his response to the trash talk was, come over here and make us prove it, but I don't think that will be happening anytime soon.
There is a sort of lip-smacking quality to both John Carlin and Jim Comey's reaction to this. They obviously have been deeply frustrated by watching these guys operate for years, and there's an element of catharsis in this indictment that is hard to overestimate.
Yeah, and not just in the indictment, but I think in their public comments about it, I think it was clear that they enjoyed last week.
Yeah. Michael, Apple did not enjoy last week. They lost a case where they had said, I think there were problems with certain apps and that Apple had nothing to do with other than allowing them into the store, and they were held not to have a Section 230 immunity for allowing those apps into the store, which was a little bit of a surprise to me. What was actually going on there?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting case because what's at issue was in the suit, which was brought against Apple and 14 app developers whose apps were sold in the iStore, was whether Apple made itself a contributor or a developer of the content in the app's privacy policies that was misleading. At issue was the fact that the apps allegedly harvested people's contact information on their mobile devices without their authorization or knowledge. Apple claimed that it was immune from suit under Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which immunizes a website or an interactive computer service, but in this case a website, for the statements of third parties. So the typical case is, you know, a website that publishes third-party content can't be held liable for that content unless it somehow contributed to it. Here, the plaintiff said that Apple's guidelines for app developers said, quote, don't force people to give you information that you can easily find for yourself, such as their contacts or calendar information, close quote. And quote, if possible, avoid requiring users to indicate their agreement to your end-user license agreement when they first start your application, close quote. So the allegation was that Apple was essentially encouraging the app developers to use mechanisms to harvest users' data without the user's knowledge. And the court said that those statements effectively voided any immunity that might have applied because it made Apple responsible for the content of the apps. To me, the most interesting thing was, you know, this is, I'm not even sure that this is properly a case for 230, even if Apple hadn't encouraged allegedly encouraged the violation of privacy, because what was at issue was the functionality of software. It wasn't really statements by the app developers. So I was scratching my head wondering why the plaintiffs didn't argue that, you know, that's simply that the 230 wasn't even relevant here because we weren't talking about third-party statements. You were talking about third-party software.
Yeah, I think one of the things we're starting to see is a breakdown in the principle of 230. Increasingly, the idea was originally people who are bringing us the Internet, bringing us all the access to all these other individuals, couldn't possibly ride herd on those individuals or the places that they take you to. And now that some of the Internet companies are really big, there's increasingly a view that, no, yeah, you are a kind of insurer of the quality and propriety of the experience that you bring people to, even if the experience is actually provided by a third party. We'll sort of see that in the Google decision out of the European Court of Justice, I think.
Yeah, I think courts still don't generally go that far, and they typically have found the website to have no immunity, only if it really does do something to encourage the content that's the basis for the suit. You know, and here you do have these guidelines that do seem to be telling app developers, you know, don't get permission if you don't have to. You know, if it's easier to get it on your own without permission, then go ahead and do that. Which is kind of strange that they, you know, that their lawyers didn't delete that from the guidelines.
Well, as somebody who's had to page through those damned approvals, just saying, yes, 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 I accept that too, you can understand why they might say, you know, the more you ask people to agree to all these things expressly, the less attractive the initial experience is. Speaking of unattractive experiences, Sabu is getting sentenced right now. This is Hector Montegur, if I've probably butchered his name, but the anonymous hacker who turned on his buddies, turned many of them in, is accused of having pointed some of them at various foreign government sites, and there was a very detailed sentencing memo that was released. Jason, did you take a look at that? Do you know what's happening to Sabu as we speak?
I did. I worked on the case, and I can't pronounce his name either, so you shouldn't feel bad. I just referred to him as Sabu. Well, it is common practice in the Southern District of New York, where this defendant was prosecuted and became a cooperator, that when a cooperator is ready to be sentenced at the conclusion of the case, the government files a written motion for a reduction in sentence on the basis of the defendant's cooperation. And the purpose of the letter is to lay out for the court all the different ways in which the defendant cooperated and to satisfy the court that the defendant's met the standard in the sentencing guidelines, which is that he provided substantial assistance to the government in the investigation and prosecution of other people, and that's often referred to as a 5K letter, named after the provision of the guidelines that enables a judge to give a reduction in sentence based on cooperation. And this letter was, as they often are, quite detailed, and it laid out in really a great deal of detail all of the different ways in which Sabu cooperated from almost the moment that he was arrested in 2011, including his work against LulzSec, the splinter group of Anonymous and some associated Anonymous hackers, but also his help in disrupting at least 300 cyber attacks against U.S. government and private sector targets and helping identify vulnerabilities in their systems, and providing information that allowed the U.S. to notify some foreign government targets that their networks are being targeted as well. One thing I found was most interesting is that his bail was revoked for about 7 months for what the letter referred to without elaboration as unauthorized online postings, which, if you read between the lines, suggests that Sabu was doing, despite the 24/7 surveillance and the keylogger, that perhaps Sabu was engaging in some online activity that was not pre-approved or at the direction of law enforcement. That is, in many cases, that kind of activity is the kiss of death for a cooperator and results in the person's cooperation agreement, you know, figuratively being torn up and the government being within its rights not to make one of these 5K motions at all. I think it's the government basically gave him a chance to rehabilitate himself. He was locked up for 7 months and then released again and didn't repeat the behavior. And I think it's a measure of how significant the government thinks his cooperation is and the value he provided that the government is willing to tell the court about that, but not use that as a basis to throw the agreement out and altogether.
Well, it was very interesting. He apparently says he's actually been threatened on the street. You know, I wouldn't know him if I walked up to him. I could share a cab with him. I still wouldn't know who he is. I don't know who it is who's stopping him on the street and threatening him.
Well, he's pretty extremely well known in communities of hackers, and his picture has been in the paper. Various photographs of him have made their way into the press, online and print over time, and I think even there were a number of hackers who, prior to his outing as a cooperator, only knew him as Sabu, knew him well as Sabu, and then got a name and a face to put with the nickname. And his cooperation was sort of a nuclear event in Anonymous and its splinter groups and among hackers generally. And so it's actually not surprising, although this is, you know, I have a violent crime background before I became a cybercrime lawyer, and I'm not used to the two worlds colliding, people actually threatening cooperators in cyber cases. But his cooperation, the fact that he chose to do it and that he cooperated against a lot of his friends, I think really struck a nerve with hackers who saw it as a real sort of breach of loyalty. And so it's actually not surprising with that, in that context that he would be the subject of some threats. I think the government had to move him and family members at least once.
So the other big case that we've been following is there have been indictments in the Black Shades case, big international ring providing malware that was used to extort funds from a bunch of people. Jason, did you follow that?
I did. This was really quite a week for the FBI and the Justice Department last week, because around the same time as the indictment against the PLA hackers was being announced, I think the next day DOJ announced charges against the makers and users of Blackshades, alleging that it was used by thousands of hackers worldwide to hack into and hijack more than 500,000 computers. Blackshades, for those that don't know, is a remote access tool. The government says it was created by a guy in Arizona and a guy in Sweden, both in their early 20s, and it was sold online through a website, Blackshades website, for about $40, and was purchased by thousands of customers in over 100 countries who then were able to use that malware to do such things as activate victims' webcams, to use keyloggers to steal their passwords and login credentials, and to search their files on their computers. And it also had a unusual feature. It had a file hijacker, which was a tool to lock or encrypt files unless the owner of the computer agreed to pay a ransom, and even had a form ransom letter that hackers could use in implementing that strategy. The Arizona co-creator of the software has already pled guilty and is cooperating, which is partly what led to this indictment last week. The co-creator from Sweden is in jail in Moldova. He's been in jail since late last year, and the U.S. is seeking extradition. The other defendants in last week's case include an employee of the organization who marketed the software and provided technical assistance to users, and then two others who were charged with using the software to take over the computers of a large number of victims. This means that it is easier to get a human being on the phone to get technical assistance when using Blackshades than it is for me to get a human being on the phone when I have a problem with my ISP. But so it was remarkable that this organization was run like an actual organization with a customer service department. It was, as you alluded to, part of a multinational operation. There were raids, over 300 searches, and arrests of over 90 people in 19 different countries who had bought or used the software last week. So it was a real multinational operation and a nice companion to the PLA indictment.
So one of the rules presumably now is if you're going to buy a remote access tool and then use it to gain access to people's computers and extort money from them, you shouldn't pay for it with a credit card?
you probably should find some other way to pay for it. I think that they were able to trace, as I understand it, they were able to trace from the website, trace back to the customers and identify the customers in that way.
Well, sure, because otherwise you couldn't get customer service. You couldn't get support if they didn't know who you were. That raises the next question that I'll ask you and Michael. Just how much dope can you smoke and still get a job with the FBI doing this cyber investigative work?
Well, Michael used to work at the FBI. I just work with the FBI, so I don't know if he wants to take the first crack.
Well,
no pun intended.
I had to do my background clearance at the end of 1997, so that was a long time ago. But my sense is it probably hasn't been liberalized too much. And my recollection was that you were not allowed to have smoked marijuana in the last 3 years, and you couldn't have done harder drugs. I think it was the last 5 years, maybe it was 10. But not only that, you also have to take a lie detector test. So, presumably you can't lie about how recently or how much pot you smoked. I think also with pot, you couldn't have tried it more than 5 times.
So I thought the FBI was complaining that they were unable to hire all the people they wanted to hire because too many of them had smoked dope more than 5 times or within 3 years. And that this was really starting to hurt their recruiting efforts.
Well, Louis Free said this back in the 90s, and I think that led to the liberalization, because I think before Louis, you couldn't have tried marijuana at all if you wanted to be an FBI agent. So he significantly liberalized it. I'm not sure whether it was changed at all. I tend to doubt that Mueller liberalized it further, but, that's just my supposition. And then last week, the current FBI director, Jim Comey, made a you know, somewhat joking remark that he's having trouble hiring people to be cyber investigators because they want to smoke weed on the way to the interview. And then Senator Jeff Sessions, you know, took him to task for that, saying, you know, don't you realize marijuana is a serious problem, and you know, we don't need government officials treating it as a joke. And then Comey promptly said, oh, that he was just he was kidding, that he's against marijuana use, but that he did identify a serious problem that they are having trouble recruiting. So, you know, I suppose you could see somewhat of a liberalization, although given the reaction from Senator Sessions, that may not happen. It may not be worth the candle to Comey, at least in the near future.
Well, maybe they could relax the rule that says when you go online to do an investigation for the FBI, you still have to wear a white shirt and black shoes.
True enough.
Okay, I see the California Attorney General put out a privacy document, and I wondered if you had a chance to look at it and whether it actually provides some useful standards on privacy and data and security.
Yeah, I think it's good guidance. It relates to implementation of the California Online Privacy Protection Act, known as CalOPA, and that's the statute that was passed in 2003, which essentially requires commercial websites and online services to post their privacy policies in a conspicuous way. You know, pretty much everyone has a privacy policy now, but this is the only law that I'm aware of in the U.S. that legally requires you to do that. And in 2013, the law was amended to require the same entities to explain how they respond to do not track signals that people's browsers emit, because you know, do not track is a voluntary program, and even if people set their browsers to tell websites that they don't want to be tracked, websites can go ahead and track anyway. So under the CalOPA, you've got to let users know in your privacy policy whether you how you respond to do not track signals. Do you comply with them or not? And then there's a whole bunch of stuff in this guideline about how to go about implementing all of these requirements. You know, what constitutes conspicuous placement of your policy? What sorts of things do you have to disclose about whom you share personal information with, things like that? You know, what sort of security measures do you need to use to protect PII? So I think it's useful because the law isn't all that specific, and so now you've got the California Attorney General saying, okay, here are the sorts of measures we expect you to have in place. And since she has gone after companies that she considers to be or to have violated the act, I think this is useful. And this applies to any website or online service that collects PII of Californians, which, you know, is pretty much any
pretty much everybody. Language.
Yeah, pretty much anybody.
Okay, well, I wanted to tease the Steptoe data breach tool that Jason is working on, but we're going to have to move to our interview. Jason, you want to give us 20 seconds on the data breach tool, and we'll talk about it some more next time?
Sure, we could talk about it more next week. We're a few weeks away from releasing an online resource that we think will be helpful to companies of all sizes and all industries that gives guidance and really practical guidance for steps that a company could take prior to a breach that would help put itself in the best position to survive a breach, as well as some guidance about incident response. So unlike a lot of law firms which focus their online tools on data breach notification, law comparison charts, and things of that nature, which we also have, our tool is designed not just to help you respond to the incident, but also to give you concrete steps you can take before an incident even occurs that will help shore up your defenses and reduce the risk of a breach and increase your chances of surviving litigation and FTC investigations if a breach occurs.
Very cool. Very cool. Okay, I do want to hear more about that next week. But now let's turn to our guest, Peter Scharr. We're talking about I asked Peter to get on the call because he's an enthusiastic supporter of the Gonzalez decision from the European Court of Justice, which ruled that Google had to take down accurate information, even though the website that had the information about the Gonzalez's forced judicial sale of property, because it was a violation of the individuals of Gonzalez's data protection rights. The reaction in the United States has been somewhere between astonishment and outrage. I think I suggested that the justices might in fact be clinically insane when they adopted this. But Peter thinks it's quite reasonable, and I wanted to make sure he had a chance to express that view. Peter, would you like to very briefly describe the decision, and I'll also ask Maury Schenck to weigh in from London on the case.
Hello. Well, from my point of view, there are three main issues. The first is that search engine operators have to be seen as data controllers. That means that they are responsible for the information they transfer to their customers and the users. They are not the only and perhaps the main controllers of the data, but they have a specific amount of responsibility, and if they deal with the data, if they process the data and transmit the data, they have to consider other interests, and privacy is one of the issues that they have to consider. Not copyright also, and other things. So they are not only processors; they are not only providing a technical tool. Second is that the European Court of Justice said, and for me this was a little bit surprising, that that Google falls under the European jurisdiction completely, because they are active on the European market, and they are targeting here. People here, and they are, they have also subsidiaries in Europe, and even if the decisions are made in the U.S., they act in actively in Europe, and therefore they fall under European law. And the third is the so-called right to be forgotten. That means that in a specific case, There might be reasons to delete data that has been published years or decades ago.
Yeah, I think those are the three things that were most striking, and the two earlier ones that got a little less attention are nonetheless pretty surprising in the sense that the search engines don't really generate new information. They simply create lists of links in order of likely interest to the reader of other people's information. But the court took a very mechanical view of what the statute provided, saying, well, they processed the information, didn't they? And therefore, they're a data processor, and their processing is governed by the data protection rules just like any other processing. Is that more or less what they said?
Well, I think the court distinguishes between different kinds of controllers. So they are not completely, not fully responsible for all types of information they process. But if there is a complaint against a specific piece of data that was stored and processed and transmitted by Google, they have to look into the case, and they have to check whether legal requirements are met. This is this is the main outcome of this ruling.
I think that's right, but let's just spend a second on who's a data controller, who processes data, because it seemed to me that if Google is a search engine is a controller of data, then if I walked or, you know, spent my morning browsing the internet and collecting information that I thought was interesting and then put it on my blog, I would be a data controller under this standard. I would have processed the data and then made it available in a particular format, and that's sufficient to make me a data controller, isn't it?
Yes, you are a controller too, this constellation, yes.
Which
from the European point of view.
Yeah, which I think means that, and this is one of the things that's sort of gobsmacking in its reach. Every piece of information and anyone who passes it on, at least if they use a computer to do it, is subject to the data protection rules if they can be brought within European jurisdiction. It is an assertion that the...
if you act in the public, that might happen. Not if you are a private man and you process it on your home computer. You are not subject to data protection legislation. But if you go to the internet and you publish, you provide the public with the data, then data protection law is applicable.
Well, I would have thought that I would be covered in any event, because many companies that collect information and only use it for their own purposes are viewed as data controllers. So I can't be that making it public is the key to being a data controller.
Well, if a private person makes it public, the private person has to comply with data protection requirements. But if a company collects data, personal data, the Data Protection Acts and the data protection legislation at all is applicable.
Okay.
This is not. This doesn't depend on the publication.
I see. Okay. So, but that is still a sweeping assertion of jurisdiction that anyone who talks about facts relating to any other person online is subject to the authority that information is subject to some kind of government control.
If you publish it, if you as a private person, if you are a private person and you use the data for private purposes and you are transmitting it to your friend or to your friends, this is not subject to data protection legislation. But if you are a company and you are processing the data, or if you are a private person who is publishing to the general public specific pieces of personal data, then you have to comply with data protection legislation.
But of course, we know that no one talks anymore. They always put it someplace online, which makes them a publisher.
This is true. It is very difficult to distinguish how far some words you use in a social network like Facebook have to be seen as publicated.
Yeah.
So this is really a difficult issue. So you have to look into the character of this conversation, and then you have to decide whether the data protection legislation is applicable or not. From my, from my perspective, there must be a redefinition of what is private activity and what is commercial activity and professional activity, and we should focus on those both.
So, and the jurisdictional limitation is interesting. The court said, we don't know, we have no reason to think that Google actually does any of this processing in Spain, but because they have an establishment and the establishment collects ads and the ads ultimately are shown potentially opposite the searches, we think that any collection of search data is done in the context of the establishment, because the establishment is about getting ads, and the ads support the search links, and therefore we can assert jurisdiction over the search itself. Is that pretty much what the court said?
Well, I understand the judgment in a way that the establishment should not be seen isolated. It is part of a bigger organization, and the purpose of this organization is the provision of the search engine and other services, and one core activity is the collection and transmission of personal data, and therefore these activities fall as a whole under the jurisdiction of the Spanish legislature. This is my understanding of the court ruling.
So what I publish on my blog is not subject to the Spanish Data Protection Authority. Unless I happen to take ads. Unless I set up something to encourage people to put ads on my my website.
I would say, so far as you act in the U.S., you have no establishment in Spain, and your activities are focused on the U.S. or on other markets and outside Europe. You do not fall under European jurisdiction.
So what is your sense about whether this will apply to Google US searches, Google.com searches, as opposed to Google.es searches?
I am not sure whether you can only define it by the top-level domain. It's the question, is a market targeted or not? You can target the German market by using a com domain. This is only a technical question, but if you are doing advertisement for German companies, and you are addressing German customers by using German language, and you are providing payment tools, for example, for those who are providing their advertisement in Germany, then you fall under German jurisdiction.
So even if you did this in English, let's say, it was a search of Siemens, the ads that get served to a search of the word Siemens, some of them are in English and some of them are in German. Siemens could say, I'm sorry, .com has to take down those search results if we think that they are irrelevant.
I think even your legal system knows that U.S. is target, economic activities of German or European companies, then they have to comply with your requirements. This is more or less what the European Court of Justice said.
Targeting Germany is a little hard to know. If many searches in Germany are in English, or certainly can be consumed in English.
But if I use Google and in Germany, and even in English, I am provided with advertisements of German companies.
Yes.
And if I go to Macedonia or wherever, I get their domestic advertisements, and therefore they pay for what Google is doing, and they do this because they want to target their domestic customers.
So on that theory, I see the theory, but that means that Germany will be the German government, or the German Data Protection Authority, which is part of the government, will be determining what I as an American can read about in my search results, right? That there'll be censorship at the instance of the Spanish or the German Data Protection Authority, and I won't necessarily even know what's been taken out at the order of a foreign government.
Well, Well, you can reason the U.S. Whatever you want. So far, it is in line with your legal system. This is completely clear that if you are targeting or search engine is collecting data, is collecting information in other countries like Germany, and they do their business here, and they get a lot of money there for their business. They are very successful economically. Then you have to comply with our law, our legal system.
Yeah, but your law is governing the searches that I do in the United States, then.
Not necessarily. If you, this is a question of deletion. It's a question how far the search engine is obliged to delete. But the question on the other end is the data stems from Spain in this specific case. And it is provided to Spain. And the advertisement is done to the Spanish market. And there is an establishment of Google in Spain. Therefore, the court says, well, in this constellation, the Spanish legislation on data protection is applicable.
Yeah, I think it's probably still to be determined, but I think you've made the case and quite plausibly that if German companies buy ads on Google.com, that will give the German Data Protection Authority a basis for regulating Google.com.
Yes, and on the other, well, in this limited frame, not in general, only so far German data are collected, all the data are provided for German customers.
Ah, okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about the standard. What has to be done? Because I thought that there were some surprising elements to this from someone in the United States. The court more or less said it doesn't matter whether it's true. It doesn't matter whether the company that first put it up has been ordered to take it down. In fact, the company that first put it up can be permitted to leave it up, and the search engine can still be prohibited from using that link, and it's not necessary to show that the information causes prejudice. So, what is the standard that is supposed to be used about deciding when a piece of information must be forgotten?
Well, this is a very difficult question, and it depends on the national law. I think the German legal system is much more focused on freedom of expression and freedom of information as the Spanish law is. So we will have differences between the different European countries now. This is one of the difficulties after this decision. So, but the court says that even if a specific piece of information has been or was legally publicized, there might be circumstances not to communicate this to a worldwide public anymore after a period of time. This is what the court says, and it is difficult to understand where are the limits, and the court says there must be a balancing. There must be done a balancing, and Google has to do this. And for me, it seems very difficult for Google to do this work, and it is more probably from my perspective that Google will take down much more information than it is required to do.
So on those questions you asked, Stuart, Peter started by saying, you know, there was three main elements of the decision. The court had four holdings in its decision, and three and four relate to this right to be forgotten, but four is the one where they say you can consider a right to be forgotten. Three is the one where they specifically say, in doing this balancing, the court may still require it to be deleted even if it was legitimately published elsewhere. And it seems to me that that's the holding that has gotten a lot of the American press up in arms, that it's a freedom of expression matter, that it's legitimately published, however, you can't link to it. And I would, you know, direct, you know, there, the Article 7F of the Data Protection Directive says processing is okay if it's for the purposes of legitimate interests pursued by the data controller, unless it's outweighed by the rights of the data subject. From a U.S. perspective, freedom of expression wins here. I'm curious of Peter's view on that point. Is that the right balancing on freedom of expression?
Well, this is a question. I'm not, as Stuart said, enthusiastic about this decision. I think this is one of the weakest points, because the court doesn't mention the freedom of expression explicitly. The court only says that there must be a balance between different interests, commercial interests and interests of the public to access specific pieces of information, and the individual rights to privacy. So from my point of view, there are a lot of practical questions coming from this perspective and relating to this point, because it is very, very difficult to define where are the limits for further processing of a piece of data that is public, still public.
Yeah, I actually think it's the decision is crazier than that. The court acknowledges that there are two interests at stake here. One, Google's interest in providing this information, and they more or less say, oh, that's just an economic interest, we can ignore it. And then they say, and then of course, there's an effect on the legitimate interest of internet users in having access to the information. And they then say, the data subject's rights are protected by law, and they override, as a general rule, the interest of internet users in having access to this information. So it is quite explicitly saying, when it comes to freedom of expression, which is general, and the very specific interest in not having this information disclosed, even if true, even if not prejudicial, the data protection subject wins unless you can show something very special about the interest of others in getting access to this information. Isn't that really what it says?
I think it's correct what you said. And the problem is that the court is not mentioning this fundamental right to freedom of expression. So this is one of the lacks or shortcomings of the ruling. The court says that there must be a balancing. And there are some criteria, but in general, this is right. The right to privacy has a very high value, and it overrules the economic interest. That is what the court says.
Yeah,
there was an article I was reading as we were preparing for this discussion about a campground in Spain that was had an explosion many years ago, and some people were killed, and they were saying, well, it's terrible that this, you know, is still up there because we can't rebuild our business. And it seemed to me, you know, maybe from their perspective that's true, maybe they were not a cause of the explosion, but you know, it's also terrible that these people died, and sometimes bad stuff happens in the world. The American perspective would be, you know, have the information out there and let people judge. Maybe they want to decide whether they go to this campground because perhaps they didn't do a good job in preventing the explosion. Who knows? And so it seems to me from an American perspective, it's just the – and I sit in Europe and I really believe in data protection law, but it seems to me the balance was struck in the wrong place.
Well, from the American perspective, I could imagine the freedom of expression overrules privacy in general. I understand our European system that these are both fundamental rights, and we need to meet a balance, to find a balance between these to rise. From my perspective, in the private sector in the U.S., there's a clear overruling power of the freedom of expression.
So one of the questions, if there's going to be balancing, the question is who's going to do it? And we talked a little bit about this, Peter, whether the Data Protection Authority is going to make decisions about, yes, that should be taken down, that can be left up, or whether Google is going to make those decisions. Do you think that that decision, the question of who does the balancing, is resolved by this, or do we have to wait for another set of decisions out of the European Court?
Well, the controller is responsible, so Google has to decide. So, but the individual has the right to go to the Data Protection Authority and deliver a complaint against the decision of Google, and they also can go to court. So that will be that will happen, and I think that Google will create a kind of automated procedure to delete data, perhaps more data than it is obliged to delete after this decision.
I think you're right. It'll come up with a script that sort of has the way it has done with YouTube, where somebody makes a copyright complaint and it's automatically taken down.
Yeah.
And that means that it's in Google's interest really to take down practically everything that results from a complaint, isn't it?
That might happen, yes. Unfortunately.
Yeah, because am I right that there could be a fine if someone fails to take down the information because they don't believe that the balance should be struck that way, that the courts could later say, well, you got the balance wrong and therefore we're going to fine you?
This might happen. But if Google installs procedures for considering and for seeking the procedures, such a balancing, then it is very unlikely from my perspective that there will be fines. But it may happen. It depends on the national legislation and the practices of the data protection authorities, how robust they enforce the legal requirements.
All right. Well, we have gone over the time we usually go, but Peter, you were an eloquent explicator of the decision and a defender of some but not all of it. So I very much appreciate your coming on here. And Maury, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thank you very much for the interview.
Sure.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Thanks to Michael, Jason, Maury, and Peter. We do want to make sure that we give everybody who's participating here a chance to talk about any additional speaking engagements or written material that they're going to be releasing. Maury, Peter, do you have any upcoming speeches that you'd like to mention during this last part of the program?
Well, in June, I'm on the I'm in Washington D.C. I'm on this health privacy summit. I think it's on the 4th of June, and there I will deliver a keynote on big data and data protection.
Excellent. Okay. Well, we're looking forward to that, Maury.
This week, nothing new.
Okay. All right, and I have a speech coming up this Saturday for the Third Circuit's Judicial Conference, so that should be interesting as well. Just to close, this has been Episode 21 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. I want to thank Michael Vadas, Jason Weinstein, Maury Shank, and Peter Scharr. We hope you'll join us again next week when we'll have Ron Dibert from the Monk Center on, and we'll once again be talking about the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government. Thank you very much.